You're listening to The Stack, first broadcast on the 8th of August 2015 on Monocle 24. Broadsheet, investment and digital dilemmas. What's next for Nikkei and the Japanese media? Remote Texas or sublime Montana? A showcase of print from the United States, plus a multitude of choice at the Milanese newsstand. Multinationals and independents in Italian, Japanese or English. The print industry totally covered today on The Stack. Today on the programme, Monocle's editor-in-chief gives us the media landscape lowdown from Japan as news of the massive purchase of London's Financial Times by media giant Nikkei really begins to sink in. How will this affect this title and many others? Plus, Tyler will be leafing through some of his top picks from the Japanese newsstand. We'll then transport ourselves to the luscious, bewildering environs of rural America and speak to the creators of the stunning title Collective Quarterly as the third issue hits the shelves.
I don't think we will do an issue anytime soon on Brooklyn or Venice Beach near LA or anything like that. We're very intrigued by the hideaways, really, those kind of unseen places that take some effort to get to.
Then, as Milan swelters in the August heat, we send our correspondent to a venerable local edicola or newsstand to see what the Milanese are taking with them as holiday reading.
I might read Architectural Digest Italy. I might read Living, which is the Corriere della Sera magazine for interiors. I might read El Decor.
All that coming up, and plenty more besides, today on The Stack, Monocle's dedicated print industry analysis show. You are listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. Now, we like to launch the show, as always, by hearing from our editor-in-chief. When he's not here to present the show in person, we go to him wherever he is in the world. And he's in our Tokyo bureau right now. Tyler-san, very good to hear from you, as always. How's Tokyo treating you?
Tom-san, it's treating me very well. But also, I have to say that everyone's wilting in Tokyo because just on Friday afternoon, it was official. It was the hottest day of the year. Here in Tokyo, I think it hit sort of 37 or 38 degrees. But the good thing about Tokyo, though, is that everyone, they do dress for the weather. Just everyone goes into super shorts mode. Everyone goes into a t-shirt. There's nothing else you can do about it. I always say, you know, in Japan, as long as you make a bit of an effort, as long as you've got some funky hairdo going on or you're, you know, you're accessorizing in an interesting way, you're forgiven for wearing shorts. So it was, anyway, but nevertheless, yeah, it's been a hot week. How's your week been, Tom-san?
Not too bad. It's a little sort of, I don't know, kind of clammy. I don't know. London doesn't, you know, it tends to only give you a handful of proper nice English summer days, and we're not really enjoying those right now. So yeah, a little, I'd say, mildly moist, Tyler, unfortunately.
Okay, well, it's almost like that here, but the good thing is that the Tokyo bureau is properly air-conditioned. Though I have to say, our colleagues who run the bureau here, Tom, they like to keep things at about 24, 25 degrees. Mm. They listen, they've consumed the Kool-Aid, at least over on this side of Asia. They do a bit of cool biz here, which, of course, people who may not be familiar with this is the Japanese government program to not over-air-condition, which I'm sort of all for, but when it's kind of 40 degrees outside, I like to crank it down to 20 degrees.
Exactly, you have to draw a line somewhere. Now, Tyler, in a moment or two, we're going to talk about some magazines. I know you've got a bit of a stack of your own happening there in the bureau right now.
I do, over here, absolutely.
Before that, just to sort of continue that weather theme, general comments. I mean, is the sun sort of shining on the Japanese newsstand broadly?
I think it is. And a lot of the conversation, of course, you can't get away from the Nikkei discussion and the FT. It is, it's amazing how it punctuates so many conversations. And of course, people know that the Nikkei are an investor in Monocle. So, you know, that might kick off some conversations. But I have to say, I've met so many people in Tokyo over the past 4 or 5 days, though, who probably are quite distant from things, who probably don't even know about a relationship. And, oh, it's like, you know, Tasa, what do you make of this deal, you know, that Japan, you know, bought one of the most respected newspapers in the world. So that has really been really sort of front of mind. And I think there's a sense of pride here, Tom, that people are really excited that this is a real symbolic moment that, you know, maybe it's not the biggest deal out of corporate Japan, but certainly when you think about the acquisition of a big brand, this has people quite excited, actually.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that, Tyler, because we've just started to see in some of the British press here, really for the first time actually since the deal was announced, some questions being asked about what exactly the Nikkei ownership will look like. Could it shape editorial or shift editorial direction? You've got quite an interesting vantage point on this because you understand that medium very well, but you've also got a better understanding than most of sort of Japanese corporate culture. Do you have any, what do your sort of instincts tell you, Tyler, about how that relationship could grow over time?
Oh, Tom, if people would have been sitting around on table 27 or table 34 at Shiseido Parlor when I was having lunch with all of my Nikkei friends on Wednesday, they would certainly be sort of saying a lot. We are very close to this. We've been having some interesting conversations. I think that the main message I think that is coming through, though, the Nikkei is very proud of this purchase. This is a brand that is, meaning the FT, is doing a lot of things right. I think what's more interesting what this deal has done is it's actually prompted a lot of soul searching, I think, on the part of the Nikkei. But also, I think your question about sort of the Japanese media establishment, you know, how could it be that, you know, this was the world's second biggest economy, it's now the world's third biggest economy. You know, how could it be that, of course, you know, their biggest news brand in many ways is so unknown? So I think there's this sense right now, does the Nikkei and maybe some of their competitors, do they have to really start sort of crafting a message and a story where people elsewhere in the world, you know the power and the scale and the size of these businesses? And I think that's actually the bigger question as opposed to what are they going to do with the Financial Times? And what I seem to hear is that they are going to leave it alone. I think there is, you know, they're even sort of saying, oh God, you know, are people, is going to become the Nikkei FT and things like that? No, that's absolutely not why they were looking at the brand. They know the power of it. But is it powered by the Nikkei? And are there many things that the Nikkei, of course, can bring to the broader deal? Absolutely. And I think that's, of course, a very exciting thing when they look at sort of the correspondent network, et cetera. So I think from a news gathering point of view, there's certainly a lot that is brought to the party. But I don't think people have a lot to worry about. I always come back to that notion, you know, here's a newspaper that not just in London, you know, where they're covering just the Japanese football industry with correspondents all over the world, which is kind of amazing.
It is amazing indeed. Some of the insights there of Tyler Brulé, Monocle's editor-in-chief from our Tokyo bureau. And when we come back in just a moment, Tyler's going to guide us through some things that have caught his eye on the newsstand in Tokyo this week. Stay tuned.
Do you ever feel like you've missed out on something? Have you been on the road? Miss the latest world news? Then catch up with The Recap, the best of the week's cutting-edge reports, comment, news and features from all the flagship shows on Monocle 24. Join us every Saturday from 1400 London time or via the Monocle 24 app.
You're back with The Stack on Monocle 24. Let's cross back to Tyler in Tokyo. Now, Tyler, what have you got before you? An array of fine publications. Where do you want to start?
Well, I'm just going to give you a series of names, Tom. Of course, many of these titles you will be familiar with. I'm going to throw some new names at you, and you're just going to say, stop there because it sounds good. So, okay, we've got Brutus. We've got Uomo, the summer fashion snap special.
Oh, well, hang on. I have to jump straight in on that one. Tell me about this. What gems okay. lie on upon and within?
Well, Uomo magazine is a very good men's fashion title. It has nothing to do with the Condé Nast L'Uomo Vogue or anything like that. It's its own title, and I'm looking at it's a very nice cover. They've probably taken about one third of the top of page. They've got a very summery aqua background, Uomo's on white, and then as it says, they've got the fashion snap special. Now, a lot of magazines are into this snap franchise, Tom, and that means just, you know, capturing fantastic looking, in this case, men's magazine, guys on the street with really outstanding street style. I'm actually looking at one of our models, in fact, a gentleman who's in our September issue, in fact. He's actually one of the people who is snapped on the street. We've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, sort of 10 guys on the cover. Curiously, though, one of them looks like our Shu Terase, who, of course, runs our London shop. It's a large hat on it. It may well be him. I don't know. Anyway, so, and if you open it up, Actually, goodness, here's an outfit for you, Tom. Have you ever sort of thought maybe, when you sort of look at your orbit, maybe I need to go sort of, you know, plantation special this morning. So
definitely,
here we've
it's always been a very sort of key influence for me. That sort of
I think this is Tom Edwards doing tea plantation. we have a nice slipper. It's a lovely sort of gentleman slipper, but you know, it's Japan, it's edgy. So there's a skull instead of a coat of arms on top of the slipper. Then I could only describe these as men's culottes. I'm not sure how you sort of feel about sort of, you know, wide cut, maybe about 4 inches above the ankle. Then you have sort of a very sort of long sleeve white shirt. And the shirt, Tom, comes sort of below the elbows. It's not rolled up. This is just, you know, it's cut that way. Mm. And with a big white wide brimmed hat to match.
It sounds kind of like Sailor Man meets plantation chic, Tyler. And I'm ready to sign up right now.
But then I think there's a lot of other outfits. Combat trouser seems to be making a comeback, Tom. How do you feel about a combat trouser?
I was going to say indifferent, but if it's making a comeback, I have to sound more enthusiastic, presumably.
You're right. And I think, look, not too far down the track, you know, you might have to put dummies and toys, and you're going to need a lot of action pockets
I'll need
in your
more,
life.
Exactly, more pockets. That's a very good thought. So that's the fashion snap. What else we got? If we delve back into the stack of magazines, what else caught your eye this week?
Well, we have many things. So of course, we like Casabrutus. We've got Popeye here today. We've got Sumu magazine. I think we should look at Sumu. Mm. Now, Sumu magazine, it's a quarterly title. It caters to a very specific Japanese aesthetic. It is a little bit, it's a little bit secondhand. It's a little bit, you built it yourself, or at least it looks like you built it yourself, but you actually commissioned a very expensive architect to do it. They're quite into also recycled woods and timbers. Everything is very woody in this magazine. Mm. You're not going to see a lot of space in Sumu magazine devoted to just acres of glass and concrete. We have a lot of stairs, sort of ladder-like stairs, a lot of staircases, quite frightening, that don't have banisters. And, you know, it's sort of not quite LOHAS, which is, you know, living of health and sustainability, or lifestyles of health and sustainability, which people, you know, still talk about a lot in Japan. A lot of, you know, very, very sort of nice, again, gardens, Tom, that sort of look like they're not particularly well kept, but that's, of course, you know, just all a bit of an affectation. So I think I'm going to bring LOHAS back for you because I'm still waiting for my dinner invite around to your joint, by the way. But
It's on the way, don't worry. Let me just ask you about that.
I'm in the Tokyo office, but
In terms of that style, you know, we talk a lot about provenance, you know, whether it's in terms of material sourced for architecture and design to products and manufacture. Is that something that kind of, do you see that theme cropping up across the spectrum of Japanese magazines, whether it's fashion, whether it's home furnishings, whether it's architecture? Is there that similar interest in provenance, or does that tend to slightly take a back seat?
No, I think Sumu is a very good example of a title which is proudly Japanese. So they're not really venturing overseas too much. You know, the odd time they might find an amazing house in Norway or something, which I think is great. But this is actually really celebrating a particular Japanese lifestyle. And they, you know, there is a sustainable message. I was laughing a little bit about it, but no, I think all of these homes are showing energy efficiency. They're using recycled timbers. You don't see a lot of advertising for air conditioning. These homes are really, you know, founded on the notion of cross breezes and good shading and sort of light and shadow and that type of interplay. So no, I think it feels firmly Japanese and is not looking abroad.
Tyler, time is a little short, so why don't I prompt you to maybe select one final option from your stack this week? Where would you like to close?
Well, I think we should close in a magazine called Go Out, don't you think?
Why not?
And Go Out is devoted, again, to a certain type of movement in Japan, which is, yes, it's outdoorsy, but it's outdoorsy with all the trappings. So it's not saying, you know, I want to go and sort of climb the hills of Scotland and really sort of, you know, do it on a budget or do it in the most honest way. I want to go and climb a hill, or I want to go and paddle down a river and just look freaking knockout when I do it. So it is, it's devoted to the best vehicles, you know. So of course, you know, if you're going to go and I don't know, climb the hills of Hokkaido, you know, you need to arrive in a good looking Suzuki. And likewise, once you get up that hill, people have to sort of think you've got the best looking tent, and, you know, what you've chosen in terms of your Gore-Tex attire has really been considered. And And there is this strange movement. You'll see it, you know, certainly even on last night here in Tokyo, Friday evening, sort of people like leaving town for the weekend, trying to escape the heat. People just buying like really like funky camper vans. I don't know how many of those Volkswagen buses, the old sort of camper style buses, have been shipped to Japan, but they've all wound up here. And there's lots of sort of, you know, great paint jobs. And in fact, the cover of the Go Out magazine is devoted to a gentleman in a, yeah, some sort of, maybe it's a souped up Suzuki with, of course, you know, one of those sort of bubble sleeping tops on, and he's got the side door thrown open in the camper bit of his little van. And he's got a Cliff Bar, you know, those energy bars. I don't know if you keep them in your desk. And he's got a Cliff Bar illustration on the side of the vehicle. And I'm not even sure if that's a bit of clever product placement. I haven't quite got to the bottom of that yet.
It very well may be. Tyler, we'll leave it there. Just briefly, where are you headed next?
Yes.
And will you be taking a camper van to get there?
Well, I probably won't be taking a camper van unless I'm putting it on a ferry across to Korea or over to Russia. No, but I will be flying over Russia, Tom. I'm heading to Stockholm via Helsinki. I think next week we might do a bit of a check-in. Could be Zurich, could be Stockholm, but we'll definitely be talking. Anyway, the countries will begin with SW. That's all we know.
Perfect. Our cards are marked for that, Tyler. Happy travels. In the meantime, great to hear from you. As always, Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, on the line from our Tokyo bureau here on The Stack. You're listening to The Stack with me, Tom Edwards. Now to the more remote and unseen parts of the USA. For every issue of Collective Quarterly, a luscious American publication, the whole team sets up camp in an offbeat location. With plenty of beautiful images, the magazine looks at the craftspeople in those places, from rug makers to distillers. Jesse Lenz and Seth Putnam are the co-founders, and they've just published their third issue. First up was Marfa, Texas, then it was Absaroka, Montana, and now Mad River, Vermont. In the future, expect to see non-US locations too. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to Seth about the concept of Collective Quarterly.
Well, Seth, a pleasure to have you here. I have to say, first, I saw your magazine by accident in a newsagent here in London. I believe it was the first issue, which was all about, you know, Montana, this region of Absaroka. It's such a visually beautiful magazine. I mean, for those who still don't know, can you describe the magazine for us to start?
Yeah, the concept is fairly straightforward. It's a magazine based about one place per issue. So what we'll do is we'll, you know, drop in to that location, so far just in the US, but we do have plans to go international when budgets and time allow. But we'll take a team of storytellers, writers, photographers, filmmakers to that location and spend about 2 or 3 weeks there, you know, documenting the people and history and place background of that area. The covers, which is probably what caught your eye at first, are these really beautiful kind of texture studies. Our kind of first stab at making a magazine was based in Marfa, Texas, which I know is a popular place to go. But we did a shot of the ground and sort of did the desert landscape there. And then that one that you're talking about, the Absaroka issue in Montana, kind of features this really beautiful macro shot of a horse. It's really striking. And I think we've decided to continue doing that for each issue. The magazine doesn't have cell lines on the cover, so it's just a very small nameplate with the issue number at the very bottom, and then a beautiful texture image.
Go. To the hardware.
And it's beautiful because you talk about craftspeople in those kind of regions. They're not necessarily the most obvious ones, you know, it's not New York or Los Angeles. So was that your intention as well, that showed that there's a lot of people making amazing things in those different offbeat places as well?
Definitely. That was absolutely by design. I don't think we will probably do an issue anytime soon on Brooklyn or, you know, Venice Beach near LA or anything like that. We're very intrigued by those kind of tucked away hideaways, really, those kind of unseen places that take some effort to get to and take even more effort to actually make a life in.
Let's talk about the latest issue, about the Mad River. What was it, a good experience to go there?
Absolutely. The Mad River is just a very intriguing, sort of zany place. It's kind of known for its architecture. And so the big kind of anchor feature that we did in that issue was all about this architectural movement called the design build movement, which essentially in the 60s some architecture students from Yale got fed up with their education and decided to move out, buy some land, and just start building and designing the houses as they went. So they would stand in the living room and see a need for a, you know, a window or a fireplace, and they just kind of tack it on. And they're still doing that 50 years later. I think this is actually the 50th anniversary of the beginning of that movement. And there, as you can imagine, there are a lot of very, very interesting characters that arose out of that.
And, you know, I want to ask a business question because, you know, it is a very, as I said, beautiful magazine, very, very lush, beautiful covers as well. Most magazines that are this kind of style, they're usually biennial. So what was your decision to be quarterly?
It's a 200 page, almost more of a book than a magazine. And I remember, you know, hearing in the last issue of The Stack that books are a little bit harder to sell than magazines, which is ironic. But our first issue came out last year. And last year we produced about two, even though we've always kind of called ourselves the Collective Quarterly. And this year we'll be on track to actually release four. So it's definitely something we had to work up to.
Things are so lush and large here, simple and drawn in big wide spaces, curvature, arcs, and just right. I like it here more.
I was very curious about the advertising in the magazine as well. Of course, you have in the first pages, you call them partners, because then you can see those beautiful ads, which are very connected to the magazine ideals, I believe. And what was your idea for the advertising?
So our advertising model is constantly evolving. I mean, we've tried a number of different things ever since we went to Marfa. You know, we've toyed with everything from product placement to more traditional page advertisements. And what we sort of discovered is that we didn't want to ruin the reading experience for our audience. And so what we landed on is those three kind of partnership spreads at the front, kind of right after the masthead and right before, you know, the main content starts. And those are reserved for the companies who really, you know, provide the most in terms of being able to fund our printing and the trips and our major expenses. And then at the very back, we sort of have a lookbook that we reserve for kind of smaller buy-ins. But we do shoot all those ads because we do want it to have an aesthetic tie that comes all throughout the magazine. Our advertising in the magazine is supplemented by what we're able to do across all of our platforms, which is really nice. Between Instagram and print, and then making films and online content, and then, you know, providing assets for our partners. That's sort of all part of the package. So it's this very interesting kind of cross-platform setup. And that reminds me of something else that we're pretty excited about. We started as a purely print magazine because we believed and continue to believe in the kind of power of something you can hold in your hand. But we're just getting ready to launch an online platform that will kind of allow us to tell stories around the country and around the globe that are not necessarily places that we're going to do an entire issue about.
Well, Seth, congratulations. It's a beautiful magazine and I am a fan.
Ah, thanks so much, Fernando. It's a pleasure.
Things are so lush and large here, simple and drawn in big wide spaces, curvature, arcs, and just right.
That was Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco speaking to Seth Putman, co-founder of the rather gorgeous American travel magazine Collective Quarterly. This is The Stack on Monocle 24. I'm Tom Edwards. Now, before we end the show, let's turn to Italy, a country that still relishes its printed matter. Summer's in full swing, with many already on holiday perched comfortably on sun lounges at the beach or relaxing in mountain lodges to escape the oppressive heat wave that's hit the peninsula in recent weeks. To keep their minds off the blazing temperatures, many Italians escape through a bit of leisurely reading, having picked up glossy titles and news dailies at their local edicola, those newsstand kiosks that are still very much an institution in every city. We dispatched our Milan correspondent Ivan Carvello to see what last-minute purchases of print media were being made in Milan by those about to head off on holiday.
A testament to Italians' love for print, the edicola, or newsstand kiosk, has resisted the push to deliver one's news via digital platform. Today, Italy still has some 30,000 edicola on streets and piazzas. At Fabrizio Prestinari's newsstand in Milan's Largo Treves Square, not far from the newsroom of Italy's main daily, Corriere della Sera newspaper, his regular clients pop in to stock up on their summer reading with a mix of high and lowbrow material to help pass the time at the beach. Newsagent Fabrizio Prestenari.
Siamo qui in edicola a Milano sotto questo caldo di Ferragosto.
I'm here at the kiosk in Milan in this terrible August heat. I'm selling papers to our customers that are mainly interested in fashion and design titles, either international or Italian, and also the daily papers, Il Sole 24 Ore, the Financial Daily, Corriere della Sera, La Repubblica, and also the International Herald Tribune that is fairly widely sold here in Milan. Our clients also get their daily fill with gossip titles, like Voici, Paris Match from France, Heat from England, and also Hola from Spain.
Heat inglese e Hola spagnolo. Prego? No, aspetta, glielo do io. Tenga, qua.
Given Milan's standing as a design and fashion capital, Prestenari ensures there's a healthy stock of titles from those fields, so time-pressed individuals can catch up on the latest trends once their holidays start.
Generally, if it's not the magazine that comes attached with the daily, I might read Architectural Digest Italy, I might read Living, which is the Corriere della Sera magazine for interiors, I might read El Decor. I mean, generally it's pretty predictable, that's my field. If I have a good edicola near the beach, I might even get to read Pinup or something a bit little more highbrow.
Do you see Italians trying to unplug from their smartphones and reading more under the sun umbrella?
Yes, but generally, I think the tradition of the giallo still resists, so it's pretty popular reading from what I can tell.
So in terms of reading, which kinds of things?
Murder stories, as if Italian life wasn't already too exciting, they tend to look for very operatic things, which are light reading. So mysteries, murder cases, political intrigue, all that type of stuff.
And you still see a lot of Gazzetta, so the sports dailies being
read? Oh, so, well, I avoided that. Yeah, well, generally, yes, if it's not pink, it's not Italy, so.
Italy's pink paper is, of course, the sports daily Gazzetta dello Sport, published by the Corriere della Sera newsroom, not far from Prestenari's newsstand. It's a popular sight at beaches all over Italy in summer, with over 200,000 copies sold daily, as football fans use their downtime to keep track of their club's summer signings in the transfer market. But not all Italians want to read about sports when they're on vacation.
What I buy in summer here in Milan as magazines are, first of all, Internazionale, because in August there is the special edition about traveling. And the second one is Arte, is the Italian news magazine about art. And the third one is National Geographic, because it's about travel and society and all the new trends around the world.
And Internazionale, what's the topic?
The topic is about traveling. Internazionale translate all the articles around the world, and the summer edition is about traveling. So there are 10 stories about traveling around the world.
Even with many in Milan already off on holiday, Prestenari's stand is still doing a brisk business, a sign that traditional media remains in demand and is an integral part of Italians' vacation plans. For Monocle, in Milan, oops. I'm Ivan Carvalho.
Those were the sounds of the Milanese Edicola newsstands as residents selected their summer reading material. And that brings us to the end of edition 154 of The Stack with me, Tom Edwards. Thanks to Tyler Brule, who joined us earlier from Tokyo, and to our various contributors today. Our producer was David Pleasant, our studio manager, Claire Urban. Comments or queries are welcome. Drop us a line at info@monocle.com and join us again at the same time next week. Goodbye.